Right. So I really appreciate your time for doing this, David. I tell you what it is sometimes, as you know, I've gone through virtually all the Word in Your Ear podcasts, and occasionally you get into the business of magazine publishing and how magazines work. Yeah. And I think I'm probably in the minority, but I think I wish you'd talk more about that.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It comes up all the time. It came up only the other day. Mark's always very nervous about it. And I say, no, some people are interested. And why shouldn't there be, you know? But anyway.
Well, I thought there's one particular thing. I thought, God, that's such a true thing. That I remember you saying with Word that everybody gets obsessed with cover price and not touching it. And in retrospect, you should have just doubled the price of it. And I thought, yeah, I'd have carried on buying it. I love Word.
Yeah, but I mean, the bigger issue with Word is sales were incredibly difficult to achieve at the same time as advertising just totally disappeared.
Yeah.
So, you know, you know, during my time in magazines, you very much played with those two streams of revenue. You know, I mean, if you could sell a lot of copies, your advertising didn't matter quite as much. You know, if sell fewer, charge more for the advertising. But what happened with Word is it was a kind of perfect storm that people stopped going into newsagents and buying monthly magazines as a matter of course, at the same time as the record industry stopped advertising.
So how do Uncut and Mojo still keep going?
Well,
good a magazine.
I mean, I don't know, but I think it's very tough, generally speaking. And I think probably both of them, you know, I don't think either of them were growing. I'm not in touch with their sales, but I don't think they'll be growing. And I think they're probably benefiting from a subscriber base built up many years ago. And like you were saying about your Zencaster, it's difficult to get those subscribers, but they tend not to go away very easily.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so there is a kind of hardcore of people who, you know, want the latest Neil Young box set or whatever. And they've benefited from that whole kind of vinyls thing.
Rebirth. Yeah, I wonder whether there are any new people coming into that.
What's more interesting is there's certainly no new magazines coming into the area, not that I'm aware of, you know. And I mean, I've got mates who work on some of these things, and I think they do a lot of specials. They do a lot of, and the other interesting thing is that they are rotating a very, very narrow cast of characters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I barely read them. I still buy them. I still subscribe and they turn up. But I find, whereas before I used to devour the whole thing, now it kicks around and I have a little flip. Because you think, how many more times do I want to read about the birth of Ziggy Stardust? I've done it 7 times now. Yeah. I've probably got that story, you know. But I still buy that for some reason. I still buy it.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So, what was your introduction to magazines growing up? Aside from the Beano, possibly, what magazines got through to you?
It was music magazines. It was Record Mirror. It was Enemy. Rave a bit later. Rave was, I subsequently realized, although they didn't say this openly at the time, it was aimed at girls. And if you look at it now, it's quite interesting. It's funny talking to Peter Frampton only the other day. Peter Frampton, who was, you know, elected the face of 68, wasn't he, by Rave, I think. And so it was very much, that was the idea, that they could get a bit of fashion advertising and, you know, it would be a kind of Andy Fairweather Low type magazine, you know. And so that, I think it, from my memory, a quite patchy distribution.
Right.
Whereas my main memory of these things growing up in the 60s, and we call them magazines now, but at the time they used to say on the front of the NME, I think it used to say registered with the GPO as a newspaper. because I think that meant it could be mailed out cheaper. Open.
Right.
And so they were print, you know, like, I mean, Record Mirror would color print, but they were print, you know. And I just remember Thursdays being the key day of the week, you know, that you would drop into the little newsagent across the road from the bus station on the way to school and just hope to God that the NME was in there. And so that whole habit, you know, was built up in those days, and it carried on for years, you know, it carried on for the next, well, I don't know, more than 10 years, you know, that idea. And it was very much affected by regular strikes or industrial disputes. And so things would disappear for months at a time, and people would be sunk into deep gloom by the absence of these things, because they were the one thin, you know, line of communication to that whole world. You know, that whole world now, and if you talk about why don't people read these things anymore, well, you know, that information and far more of it just finds its way to you absolutely all the time without you trying nowadays. But whereas none in those days, you had to try.
But none of it feels as special. I think you interviewed someone a couple of weeks ago who said they used to get some from Reading or something. They'd get on Thursday, they'd get the train into London. Well, it might have been you. Pick up a copy of the NME and then get the train back.
When I first started writing for the NME, which was 50 years ago this year, I just realized. At the time I was working at HMV in Oxford Street, and the NME used to go on sale at Oxford Circus tube station. There used to be a newsstand in there. Yeah. And it used to go on sale Wednesday lunchtime. So it was a whole day before.
That news.
So, God, you felt special, you know. Yeah. And so when your first reviews printed, you would go dashing down there from a kind of 11 o'clock Wednesday morning, hoping to God your thing would be there and they wouldn't be in. You'd have to come back and you go back again later, you know. And people used to pore over the crossword and, you know, all those things. You just can't imagine the kind of, I mean, I meet people of my generation of the same thing. Can you remember things you read in the NME when you were 25? Yes, they can. They can recite paragraphs pretty much, you know, which is extraordinary. Nobody can do that about anything.
Well, that's right. I was going to say, is there anything now that people would have that equivalent of excitement, or is it just the scarcity of information that just makes it seem so valuable? Now there's obviously information flying everywhere. It all seems
it's very weird. I got sent yesterday again. Thomas Walsh is a musician in Dublin. He sent me a thing of a load of singles reviews I'd written for Smash Hits in, I don't know, 1979 or whatever. I said, well, you need to write this stuff. And it was the soul of ephemera. You know, we never thought anything would ever return. The idea that 50 years later, later, people are sending it to you is just crazy. And he said to me, nothing in print is ever fleeting.
No.
And I said, that's a good title for a song. You know, it's kind of true. You know, nobody ever any longer gets on to you. Not that I write anything, you know, I don't write anything that appears on the Guardian webpage or whatever, but I write stuff for the Radio Times. Nobody ever comes back to you with something you wrote online, ever.
Yeah.
Because everything online is regarded as provisional. Anything on paper is regarded as, it was a tablets of stone, you know. You know, you said so and such an album wasn't very good. Yeah. Well, everybody agrees now it's really good. It's like, well, okay.
Yeah, I had my example of that was I interviewed lots of people from the advertising world. And even if they were operating in the 60s and 70s, you can generally find on YouTube and JPEGs and old magazines, you can generally put their archive together. I did a long interview with someone who was at the birth of the digital age and he was very important. And we'd done the recording and then tried to find his work. We couldn't find one piece of it.
really,
because all the websites had gone, Flash has gone. You just couldn't find anything to represent.
That's true, which
was just kind of odd, because you think, well, he's more contemporary, obviously, than the guys from the 60s and 70s, but nothing existed of his work.
Yeah, it's funny. I do often think, have I been a lucky beneficiary of the fact that I was, you know, my opinions were in print in the last era of print.
Yeah.
therefore, that's the stuff that people can reach back to. Yeah. Didn't reach back to the early 2000s at all, which may also account for this strange feeling that I increasingly have about popular music, and you could apply it to media generally, that nothing's changed this century at all.
Yeah.
You pick up anything from 2003 and drop it in this year and it'll seem perfect.
Yeah. There's no movement, yeah.
Whereas you go back 20 years before that and you can see the movement because it's in print.
So I wonder whether magazines will have a slightly similar journey to Vinyl, which is that there's already a few podcasts where I listened to one yesterday, where the idea is they pick up a copy, what yesterday's was Raid.
Oh, really?
And they go through it for an hour and a half and all the issues that come out of it. There's obviously the one on Smash Hits.
Yeah.
That the idea is. And you think, it does have a value, and they're interesting because there's so many surrounding things. You've got the ads, the reviews, the pop stars who've come and gone, the ones. I mean, there's a ton of culture in there. And I wonder whether they become more valuable and whether that...
Well, right. I think that it's certainly true. It always was true with the magazine that, and I always used to say this, that you read in a magazine, you read content and context simultaneously.
Yeah.
You didn't just read about the Eagles or whoever. You read it within the context of something where you had an ad for Loon Pants and, you know, the Brotherhood Man are going on tour or whatever. you saw the whole world at the time. Whereas when you look at individual bits, you don't. Is there any indication that will come back a la Vinyl? Well, I haven't seen any indication. I haven't felt it at all, and I do think that's interesting in the sense that, you know, I was talking to an old magazine hand the other day, and the thing that always amazes me is that whole, you know, some magazines are hanging on, you know, doing very well, and they tend to be high frequency, they tend to be high density, they tend to be print, you know, the words and spaces.
Yeah.
What's gone are color picture magazines, which used to be the leading edge. You know, I mean, the fashion magazines, the homes magazines, the travel magazines.
Yeah.
And things like Q. And, you know, they were, you know, it was a sensory experience. It wasn't just the information. It was, oh, God, look at the pictures and all that, you know.
Yeah.
It was a carrier of people's image. That has gone, and there doesn't seem to be any hunger to bring it back. Not as far as I can see. Now, that's not to say it wouldn't happen, but I haven't seen any indication. And I'm kind of amazed that there isn't some little corner where somebody has developed something that, going back to your point about cover price, you know, that somebody hasn't launched some kind of £20 a month, you know, whatever. And you know, you get all those kind of, you get all those groovy fashion magazines that you see in shops in Soho that are all about 30 quid a time, but they never seem to do it in issue two, as far as I can see. they're portfolios, aren't they? There's somebody's application for a job, I think, as much as anything else. So, no, I haven't seen it, but I think it's undoubtedly the case that if you pick up, you know, you pick up an old magazine, or it's a time capsule. It is, in a way that nothing else is.
No.
You can't do it with TV programs. And increasingly with TV programs, it's quite interesting how they've taken all apart. You know, that you can see probably individual performances for Top of the Pops, but you can't see a whole one.
No, that's right, yeah.
not least because the BBC have that's a bit of a tangent, but you know, the BBC's kind of Jimmy Savile problem, followed by its Dave Lee Travis problem, followed by its they've got themselves into all kinds of pickle, you know, so that they can hardly show any of this stuff. Yeah. It's ridiculous, anyway.
So when you went to the NME, that must have been amazing. So you'd been queuing up on a Wednesday to buy the thing, and then all of a sudden you're writing for it.
I was working at a record shop, and Fred Deller, who used to do their imports column, used to come in the shop. Fred was just a really sweet guy. That was about 5 years ago. And he used to just come in to research what all the new imports were. And I got up my courage and said, Fred, if I wrote something for the NME, would you read it? He said, yes, of course. I wrote some review or whatever, I can't remember. He read it. He said, well, that's as good as I could do. I said, well, if I wrote something else, would you give it to the reviews editor? He said, yes, I would. And he did. And so I, while working for the shop, I used to, you know, write reviews and things for the NME. And I was only reminiscing about it yesterday with my wife because somebody's just published a book called Heatwave, which is about the summer of 1976 and the great heatwave. And we were trying to piece together what actually we were doing in that time, you know. And of course, what I was doing a lot of the time was going down to Kingsreach Tower in Waterloo.
I remember that, yeah.
And going up to the whatever floor and being there early in the morning to hand in my review of the Dwight Twilley Band or whatever to Bob Woffin. It was unbelievably thrilling to see your name in print. There was nothing else in life that could equal that. Nothing you can imagine. I thought, oh, crikey, your name in print, you know, and in the NME.
Famous.
You kind of were, even though you had nothing at all, and you were really low down on the, you know, food chain in the NME. But, oh, God, you know, it was... You tried to get over to people what it meant. And it was like the NME was like the internet. There was a whole load of stuff that you would never have had any contact with at all were it not for the NME. So not just the music stuff, but just the kind of the pretentious stuff and all that, you know.
You just absorbed all of that writing that allowed it to come out by you? Because you hadn't been experienced doing that.
I used to read it from cover to cover.
That's what I mean. Had that just somehow seeped into your pores and a version of that could come out?
I'd read tons of reviews, and I didn't just read the NME. I read the other ones. I used to read Rolling Stone from quite early on, and any American things you could get your hands on, which were not easy to get your hands on, you know. They would disappear for months at a time. And also, you've got to remind yourself, there were hardly any books about music in those days. Now there are untold thousands.
Yeah.
Hardly any, you know. So there was Nick Cohen's A What Bobaloo Bobala Boom Boom. And there was, you know, I don't know, Rockfile. What was the name of the guy from Time Out? John Collis. And you used to just read these things repeatedly. You know, I could recite pages of Nick Cohn's A What Bobaloo Bob. I just took to writing and worked very hard at it. Madly hard. And I still do, you know. And your reward was a few quid, not many at all. But the main reward was just seeing your name. God. You felt 10 feet tall. You really did.
So when you explain that, it seems such an unusual move to go from NME, which is cool, a bit pretentious.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone reads it, to smash hits.
Well, yeah, because I'll tell you how that happened. I'd gone to work for a record company. I worked for Berserkly Records.
Yeah.
And done that for a year or so. And then I didn't like it. And so, you know, I jacked it in, me and my now wife, We're living in a flat, and you know, we live on fresh air, basically.
Yeah.
And I just needed work, and I got in touch with Fred Deller again. I said, Fred, do you know any work around? And Fred said, well, Nick Logan's just left NME, and he started this thing called Smash Hits. Try him. So I rang Nick, and Nick pretty much said, now I've smoothed off the edges of this recollection by telling it many times. But as far as I was concerned, he pretty much said, can you come in tomorrow?
Right.
You know? And it was just Smash Hits had just moved from monthly frequency to fortnightly because it was doing so well. And they had a little office in Great Pulteney Street. Were we talking about this the other day? Great Pulteney.
We were, yeah. You were
okay,
possibly above Cogent Elliot.
I think it was Cogent Elliot House, I think they called it at the time. Yeah. I don't know. And we just had a couple of offices on the first floor there. And so I will be in there with Nick Logan, Steve Bush, who was the original art director, whose only experience of magazines had been, well, he'd just been to art college for a year or something and then started his own T-shirt company. And then Bev Hillier, who was probably 18 at the time, who was Nick Logan's sister-in-law, who used to just sort out the lyrics for the songs, yeah, yeah. You know, and me. And there were just the four of us in there. And, you know, you pretty much did everything that it needed doing. And so it was an absolutely brilliant way to learn, you know, and the magazine was just, it just started this ascent, which continued for, I don't know, best part of 10 years, you know.
So what's the magazine that you joined? That was primarily lyrics and colour.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot. There were posters, there would be lyrics, there would be a couple of short features, and then there would be a thing called bits, which right. was the kind of news and bitty stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And then would go off and interview whoever was available, you know. So it'd be Dr. Field. I mean, it's very Smash Hits when I think about it. You know, the thing about Smash Hits, I mentioned this, something I wrote the other day. Of all the music papers I ever contributed to, Smash Hits was the most wide-ranging, you know, because there was nothing that couldn't be in Smash Hits. Nothing at all. You know, it would be, I don't know, it would be, you know, Black Lace and it would be Laurie Hanson and everything in between, you know. And so, you know, first people I interviewed for Smash Hits would be the Buzzcocks and Robin Scott of M. of pop music fame, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, Dr. Feelgood and Rocky Burnett, who was Johnny Burnett's son, you know, and just absolutely anybody. And so there was, it always had a really broad base. And, you know, I was whatever age I was, 29, 30 at the time, and Nick would have been 35 probably. So we were not of the generation reading it at all.
Well, they would have been reading it at the time. Teens.
They would be, you know, when I first joined it kind of 50-50, 15, 16-year-olds, whatever. And so Smash Hits had a kind of mission to explain. I can't remember what was it. I talk about the BBC. It's what they say of the BBC, isn't it? The mission to explain, you know. So for instance, when John Lennon was killed in 1980, there was suddenly a ton of Beatles coverage because there was genuine curiosity on the part of 15-year-old readers. Who was he? What was that all about? And you know, so you wouldn't just write about whatever was happening, the new thing in the chart. You would, you know, write about Elvis Presley, you'd write about Motown, you'd write about the Velvet Underground, you might do absolutely anything, you know. People don't think about that sufficiently. But as far as the kind of gender split was concerned, as the magazine grew, and this is one of the things that happened to magazines, is that they tend to start relatively broad. And then as they grow, they tend to get narrower.
Right.
You know, because you work out who it is that you know, is buying you. And so you work out that if you put Duran Duran on the cover, you're going to do better than if you put, I don't know, who? Donna Summer on the cover. Therefore, you tend to
you
do it more often, and therefore it'll tend to get more female. It just will, you know. And I often say that Smash Hits had its day, you know, but the kind of the mortal blow to Smash Hits, I often say, was the televising of the Smash Hits poll winners party.
Right.
All those years later, in that it was a classic case of letting daylight in on magic. That was, yeah. It was suddenly going, oh, it's all girls.
Oh, it's
okay. Screaming. Really? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And therefore that's what you are. You know? And so that's a strong argument against ever putting magazines on telly, which is something that all magazine publishers desperately wanted to do because they all wanted to sell more copies. But it tends to take away the mystique of them, you know.
So how do you – most creative endeavors that are successful are generally, I think, people doing something for themselves, you know, making an album because they like it rather than for an audience or a film. Steven Spielberg says his system for making blockbusters is, do I like it? If I like it, someone else might like it, you know. So how, when you're a 30-something, are you writing for – 15-year-old girls, and are you ignoring them or doing what you like, or
you
how are you managing that relationship?
You're doing what you like, really, but you're aware of who it is that you're communicating with, you know. And I had been a school teacher, you know, so that probably plays a bit of a part in it, but you know, Smash Hits, the people at Smash Hits didn't do okay. The people at the NME always wanted to write about their favorites, you know. So if it was the Blue Oyster Cult or whatever it was, that's where they wanted to write about all the time. That Smash Hits weren't like that at all. We wanted to do a really good magazine. That's what we wanted to do. We wanted to do a really good magazine that sold, you know. That's what got people up in the morning. And that applied to all the team. And so their idea was to do the best magazine about Duran Duran and Culture Club and whoever came next, Bros, whatever, that they possibly could. And to do a rounded package which was funny and, you know, and interesting and absorbing and had a balance of old stuff, new stuff, you know, and a very strong sense of its personality. You know, the people at Smash Hits, all the way through the time I had anything to do with it, it used to be just be able to take apart the new issue and go over it in immense detail in a way that the magazine, the people on no other magazine could do that at all. Because, you know, I always say with journalists particularly, you know, that they look at a paper and they see their words, and then the bits that aren't their words are just blur, you know. Photographers do the same thing. They see their pictures and then they see these horrible word shaped things that are alongside. People at Smash Hits not like that at all. Really not like that. They were all about how it worked together, how you got it to work.
So I was going to ask her, I presume that the people on NME Sounds weren't terribly worried about the numbers. They're more worried about what they put in. So how did you get together a group of people who were worried about whether it's
if you take my case, all I can do is talk about my case. You know, I was like 30 when I landed in this, you know, and I was kind of number two there, and then Ian Craner left and I got the job as the editor, and suddenly you were sitting astride this thing that, you know, made a lot of money, you know, and you know, the company was very focused on it, and we're growing and we're moving into bigger offices and we're taking on more people. And so there's a great sense of, you know, let's ride this tiger as long as we can. And everybody who came aboard wanted to do the same thing. And they never made the mistake of thinking it was there for their gratification at all. They used to talk about the readers all the time. All the time. In fact, if you wanted to win an argument at the NME, your argument would be based on what I think. If you wanted to win an argument that's about Smash Ears, you would always say, no, what the readers think. And that never went away. And, you know, it was never a magazine that anybody wrote for in order to have something to put in their portfolio.
Although, ironically, the tone of it became incredibly...
It became very, very influential. Very influential.
It's the kind of thing that I Googled some of the names. I was thinking, oh, yeah, what were the names of different people there? Now, if that was in advertising and you said, why don't we start calling some of the pop stars silly names for a vet description? It would be shot down as being too clever, too ironic, too adult, too... You know, there'd be a whole... So some of the... I've just got to repeat some of these names. So, obviously... Alan Ant,
yes.
Alan Ant. Sir Clifford of Richard.
Dame David.
Volleyball ping pong for Ben.
Oh, Ben Volpiero. So
that absolutely seems like people enjoying themselves. It doesn't feel like...
It was. Our
teenage girls may love this. It feels like this is funny amongst us. If they like it, great.
Yeah, but I think it was a strong indication the readers did like it.
They did, absolutely.
And, you know, we often say, you know, whenever I'm talking to people who used to work on Smash Hits, which I do, you know, quite often, the thing you always reflect upon is even given the changes in economic circumstances, you could not do that nowadays. No. Because Smash Hits... attitude to pop stars was, oh, he's an odd sort, she's rather strange, you know what I mean? That was always the point. Now you can't do that anymore, because nowadays people lead with their strangeness and it becomes a protected characteristic.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I am speaking as a gay man or as a whatever. You know, nobody did that. Now the gay thing is particularly interesting, because again, we were talking about this the other day. This was a time when not even George Michael was gay. Boy George went through the whole culture club mania without ever really saying
he was gay. Avoided the question. Yeah,
it's extraordinary to think when you think about it now, you know. There was a kind of lightness, you know, they were a cast of characters. It was a bit of a pantomime, and people liked the idea of it. And, but you know,
it didn't feel like you were trying to have a go at them. It felt like you were celebrating them in a playful way.
Well, I hope that's the way it would have come over, you know, that it's also accepting that you're more than just a constituency of fans of this lot and fans of that lot. You know, it's got to be interesting for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to be able to write about Duran Duran in such a way that people who don't like from Duran Duran nonetheless find it easy to read.
Yeah. So at the same time you're doing this, you start doing Old Grey Whistle Test. I think they overlapped, didn't they?
Oh yeah, they definitely overlapped. Yeah.
So again, that feels like an odd thing.
Oh well, that was certainly very odd. Odd in all kinds of ways. I started in 1980. So in 1980, I went to New York for the first time, Thanksgiving, 1980, and I went to see Bruce Springsteen at Madison Square Garden. And he had a party afterwards in the bowling alley of Madison Square Garden. Huge, great do. And I bumped into Mike Appleton, who was the editor of Whistle Test. And I knew Mike because I'd been worked as a record plugger for Berserkly Records, so I kind of knew him. And I'd had a couple of drinks. Not pissed or anything, but enough to say, you ought to have me on your program.
Is that what you said?
I invited myself on. And much to my amazement, of course, you know, a week after we came back, John Lennon was killed. And And in the last whistle test before Christmas, I think it must have been that, Mike got in touch with me and said, would you come on and do the Christmas books? There used to be a kind of annual thing. There will always be a few Christmas rock books. You know, there will be a handful in those days. Nothing particularly interesting, but they just, it was the kind of thing that they always got somebody in to talk about them. And so I had to go down to Shepperton and sit with Annie Nightingale and talk about the Christmas books. And following that, Mike asked me to do, I think he got me to do a thing on News Desk or something. And I did that for a while and then I ended up co-presenting it with Annie. And then when Annie moved on, Mark Ellen moved in and all that kind of thing. And it was a kind of odd mix, you know. So you'd be on whistle test introducing, I don't know, Spirit or something.
Yeah, yeah. And then Kajagoogoo the next morning.
But, you know, it's funny, you know, all these years later, when Mark Ellen and I do these, you know, Word in Your Ears, and it's, yeah, have we ever met? And people go, yeah, I was on whistle test once, you know, and I don't really remember, you know, yeah, you introduced me at the Regal in Hitchin or something. Because I now, with the whistle test, people email me all the time saying, I've just been watching you interview so-and-so. And I go, never met them in my life.
Really?
Yeah. And then they send me a link and, oh, there I am.
So would you have been nervous when you had to go on the first time to?
Terrified. Absolutely. And you mortally terrified. And it was live, do not forget.
Oh, wow.
A lot of the time it was live. There was no auto cue. And so Mike used to like, he always used to say his policy with whistle test was, I hire journalists.
Right.
And that was his way of winning. I learned early on a very important lesson about the BBC. Everything the BBC does is for reasons that apply within the BBC. What happens in the outside world is a completely secondary thing. It's always there to win a political battle or fight a corner within the BBC. Right. And that was no less the case then than it is now. And so Mike's way of protecting whistle test and saying this is not Top of the Pops was to say, no, I always have a journalist presenting it. And we always do filmed items. We do reports. That's our way. So if I get somebody on the board of governors says, how come you've got Gary Newman on this and you've got Gary Newman on that?
Yeah.
He says, no, we're doing it a different way. So consequently, Bob Harris, first presenter, was because he used to write for Time Out. Annie Nightingale, Daily Express, whatever, and me, you know, Smash It's NME and so forth. And then it continued like that. But yes, was I terrified? Absolutely terrified. And, you know, the only thing was the feeling of excitement once you'd done it was terrific.
Yeah, I bet.
Once you'd survived it, you know. And I used to... And then there was the watching yourself if it was recorded, and then watching yourself, you know, a week later at home. And I realized I could only while standing behind a sofa or behind a chair, so there was something over my genital region, because the insecurity, that's where it was felt. It was really odd, really strange.
So did you get recognised in the street the next day? Did anyone give you a funny look that they might have seen you?
I wouldn't say in the street the next day, but if you went, once you start doing it regularly, if you went to, you know, the Rainbow or the Hammersmith Odeon or whatever, you could hear people. you'd get that. But, you know.
And have you seen that back? Have you seen that clip back to check whether you were absolutely looked terrified or whether you?
I never look at anything back ever.
Okay.
Because I don't think it ever makes you any happier.
No, I'm sure. So, I went through Wikipedia or whatever. I'm surprised at how many magazines you'd launched.
Oh right.
And I thought I'd ask about what that process is. Presumably, you spot a gap in the market. So I presume Hugh is for the My Big People.
Yeah, it was a bit earlier than that, actually. Yeah, if you go back to how it started, we had Smash Hits, you know, so Smash Hits was just going great guns.
Yeah.
And so they pretty much said to me, and this is EMAP, or a company, you know, based in Peterborough, they'd never done anything that was quite as big as this, you know. And they said, well, we should look at doing something for girls, you know. And so out of that came Just 17, which was the first one, you know.
Oh, was
so,
it? Yeah.
You know, so I was managing editor or director or whatever of Smash Hits. And at the same time, me and Steve Bush, the art director, had to go over across the road and invent a girls' magazine, which we did. And that was very successful.
So what would you –
what's the process? Idea?
What's the idea that you go, we need to invent a girls' magazine?
Well, the way we did it at the time was – there's always a lot of smoke and mirrors about creativity and all this stuff, but underneath this, there's a lot of sort of basic commercial stuff. And so the big innovation that EMAP introduced into those markets was sale or return, which right. meant that you could get copies in. Because yeah. retailers trusted you, and they send them back if they don't sell them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Smash Hits introduced, they said, okay, we're going to do the song lyric magazine, but we're going to do it more expensively, better quality, color, and we're going to charge more for it. So consequently, when we did the girls' magazine, it was, we're going to do better quality than Jackie and Blue Jeans and whoever else yeah. there was. But we're going to do it in color. It's going to be better. It's going to be slightly more grown up. It's going to cost more. And that's what we did. And so that applied to pretty much everything. And so if you go to Q, that was – now, I can well remember this. I'm in this conversation with the ad people at the time we originally came up with Q when it was originally called Red. Which is, he can't do it monthly because music's not a monthly market. It's a weekly market. And we said, but no, it's got to be monthly. It's got to be a month. It's got to be a treat. It's got to be glossy, you know. And once it was launched, the frequency was never an issue at all. It was perfect because, right. you know, people, it was kind of monthly record releases. You know, it's the thing that people have a lot of difficulty trying to reimagine now, that there was a monthly magazine buying habit, which was really powerful. Not just men, it was women as well. You know, all the fashion magazines would arrive at once, you know, or all the homes. And people would look forward to that like mad, wouldn't they? And some people would buy all of them,
yeah.
you know. And some people would just enjoy choosing, you know. Suddenly, oh God! People get excited when all these things would appear on the newsstand opposite Liberty's in Great Marlborough Street. Don't you? If you're ever,
yeah, yeah,
we ever down there? Those places,
that big long. Presumably, it doesn't exist anymore.
It does exist, but it is a very kind of straightened thing, yeah. you know. And those guys, they were really good. They knew when things were coming out. They knew, you know. And there was massive excitement about that. And so, yes, it proved to be the Live Aid effect. But you know that was kind of secondary, really. You know, we had to prove the point. And, you know, we did the first issue. I think the first, the research, and we used to do some research. And they always used to say it was very difficult to research Q because we didn't do a full dummy. I've still got dummy covers here. And we always had the idea that it was going to be a montage cover. It wasn't just going to be one person. And that was we felt that was really important. You presented range.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the initial projections as to what it could sell, they used to say, well, we think we can prove it could sell about 35,000 or something like that. Well, it sold a little bit more than that first issue. And then the way EMAP just did these things was, you know, we used to promote twice a year, and it was always be two consecutive issues with some kind of gift. And, you know, if you go back to Smash It, it had been flexi discs, then it had been posters, and I don't know what. And with Q, it was giveaway booklets about rock on CD whatever.
Yeah.
And then after a while, after a number of years, it became CDs, you know. Of course, and then it became a problem that it was just, they were getting overwhelmed by the CDs. But basically, the idea was you did twice a year, you sampled more people.
Right.
And if you could, and the idea was you'd get that, you'd get a peak, and then if you could hold a decent number, you would raise your floor, you know. And we did that. We did, we, you know, during that time, if you put out, if you promote everything that I was involved in, Smash It, it's just 17, Q, Mojo, Empire, whatever, you were always raising the floor every time you promoted. Because basically more people were coming into the market all the time.
Yeah.
And that's gone. Just gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, nobody's going into Smith's at King's Cross thinking, oh, I wonder what there is. You're just not doing it, you know.
No.
Now, it's not to say it might not come back, but I've seen, I don't see any sign of it. But, you know.
So I'm that Q generation. And now I bought the first issue. I think that's the one with McCartney on the front.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So I bought that.
Paul Simon's Graceland reviewed inside. It was.
Is it on the first issue?
First issue. I reviewed it. Yeah. Yeah.
So the things I remember instantly of thinking, this is a quality item. I didn't know what Perfect Pound meant at the time.
No, no.
It was Perfect Pound. It wasn't Staples. And I liked the paper. You think it's not that shiny stuff. It feels like I'm really.
Well, it had two
item.
Grades, I think. I think I've got a copy over here. I think somewhere. It was two grades. I think initially the reviews were on an uncoated stock.
Oh, right.
I don't know why we did that, but we did.
Cost issue. What, the reviews were on a cheaper grade?
I don't think it was a cost issue. It's a miracle I found it.
Oh, wow, you got straight to the first issue.
Well, yeah. I've got, yeah. Yes, it was. It was an uncoated stock. I don't know why we did it, but that's
not why you did it. It just instantly seemed to signal a bit more sophistication.
Yeah, it was.
And
yeah.
It felt like this isn't a throwaway thing.
No.
And we didn't throw it. I did throw them away. A lot did throw them away.
No.
It felt. So why did you go for that? What was the idea behind the montage-y cover? Which, again, was unusual at the time.
Yeah, because we felt it should be about curiosity or interest rather than fandom.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, the approach of most magazines at the time, and would still be the same approach for years, I suppose, was, you know, if you put Madonna on the cover of whatever it was, the face or, you know,
yeah.
L or whatever. The message was, love me, love this magazine. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas we said, they won't necessarily love everybody's on the cover. But it, our message was, be interested in this. This is all interesting. This is, you know.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're, and I'm looking at whoever else is on the cover. It's Paul McCartney. And then it's got Joe Strummer and Mick Jones, Big Audio Dynamite. And then it's got Lenny Henry. You know, it was just kind of range, you know.
So presumably that's a deliberate, let's try and plot a spectrum and not...
Yes, yeah. And it kind of, you know, I think it did a job for us, actually. It was like a content page as much as anything.
Yeah.
You know, that we and the, that it was, and everybody was at the time very kind of style obsessed. And Q wasn't really.
So why did you go with Q rather? Did you say Red before?
Red was one of them. Yes. We. Why did we call it
Q?
Q. We called it Q because it was because the sales. You know, if you'd left it to the sales department, they would have called it Record Review.
Yeah.
And so don't get into any arguments about anything like that. No, it's called Q. Why? It's striking. It's got overtones of a question. It's got overtones of queuing something, as in, and this was the beginning of CD and so forth. And it's just punchy and it just looks good and people won't forget it.
Yeah, there's something enigmatic about a single letter, unexplained.
It worked.
It seemed cool, yeah.
It worked, yeah. And there was never a problem, really. It was talked about before the launch, but not in a huge way. And also, within the company, when you've got smash hits going great guns, and you launch Just 17, and that's going great guns, people don't argue with you.
No, exactly. He's on a rut. Go with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you then did more, which I worked on that weird little agency that I mentioned, Chromatiditon.
Oh, God, Chromatiditon.
Yeah.
So were they in the... Is that where Jeff Poulter ended up?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. You know.
So, Jeff Poulter had always done loads of advertising for EMAP.
Yeah.
Through a company called Poulter Tennyson. There you go. Chromatiditon. And they had that strange office on the way out of Covent Garden towards Holborn. Is that right?
That's right. It was
where the road gets very narrow and you can barely walk on the pavement.
When I was there, it was Drury, at the top of Drury Lane, and it felt like it didn't feel like an ad agency. It felt like a Florida hotel, lots of different rooms. They were obviously very successful, probably the decade before. So there was lots of fancy but faded furniture. It was like really weird. Yeah. And I'd only just started in it, but I remember I worked on Just 17 and more. I don't think anything ever ran, but. And I'll tell you what I did work on, which did run and it won a couple of awards, was for Motorcycle News. I did
there you go. Yeah.
I can't remember what else they had. I think there was another couple of things they worked on, maybe a gardening magazine, maybe.
Yeah. There would be. Yeah, Motorcycle News was the big engine of the company, because it was a weekly,
Yeah.
And that was in the days when if you wanted to sell or buy a bike, you had to advertise in print.
Yeah.
Moore had a very difficult birth. And didn't do as well as expected, but then recovered. And went on to huge success, under Fiona Gibson. It's kind of rather eye-watering exploitation of the kind of ladette thing.
What
I think
was that the other theme of that?
Well, that was what became the big thing in Moore. It was position of the fortnight, all that kind of stuff.
I wasn't a Moore reader.
No, well, there you go. I'm sure you wouldn't be.
So why the exclamation mark? Was that alluding to
Moore?
Saucy content. Yeah, it said Moore.
Why the exclamation mark? Because, God, that's a good question. I don't think it was ever thought of that it wouldn't have an exclamation mark. Because I don't recall ever looking at the word without an exclamation mark. Because it would just look flat. It just looked like a retirement magazine if it didn't have,
Exciting exclamation.
It's as simple as that, And I suppose, I don't know, things like hello. Does hello have an exclamation mark? It must
It will do. It feels like it probably
it
does.
Sure. Okay, it must have
an exclamation mark. Okay, definitely must have.
There's something about exclamation marks. It's just very magazine, isn't it, really?
But it's funny. I found they were definitely done, some of those ads that I sent you that were by Chromatiditon, and they fell into that trap that advertising often does. They think, well, it's called Moore. That's a good word to work with. So all the ads say versions of Moore for him, Moore for her.
Right. Yeah.
And you go, Moore what? Tell us what we're getting more of. Just say there's Moore.
I think that there was always a real difficulty with agencies getting involved in magazines. I think they're very difficult things to advertise. because they always want to make explicit things that magazines don't want to make explicit, you know. You know, because they always want you to tell them what is the knockout blow, you know, that I can tell people about.
Yeah, yeah, the big USB.
It doesn't really work like that at all, you know.
It's something else to read.
There's a certain amount of them that is smoke and mirrors, you know.
Yeah. But it made me think, why didn't you do the ads yourself? I've worked on, where's my list? The Guardian, The Sun, The News of the World, GQ, Punch, More, Just 17, and the best one was The Economist. And basically the issue you have with all of them, except for The Economist, is they say, at the time, often if you're working on a campaign or an ad, you get a week or two. But when you're working on publications, they go, we put out a paper every 24 hours. Why do you need, a week to do one page? And looking back now, you think, well, why didn't they do it themselves? I don't mean that in a horrible way, but you think you could write. You know what your market is. You've got a sense of covers and visuals. And why not?
Because I don't think you could ever do it yourself. It's an interesting point because I always tended to take the view that I think editorial people think they can do ads, and I don't think they're often right, actually. That doesn't mean that they couldn't have good ideas. The thing that you would like to have happened, but it never did in my experience, was to work alongside an agency, you know what I mean? Yeah. Because, I always used to say, and I learned a lot from agencies, just sitting there with them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like what?
Well, just simple, dumb, stupid stuff that doesn't even need repeating in the world of advertising agencies. But, you tell an editorial team, there's no point putting an announcement in a magazine unless it's got a call to action. There's no point. It's simple stuff like that. You know what I mean? Tell me what I do. How do I do it? You know. Whereas they'll tend to be over nebulous, you know. I think there could have been a case for – embedding an advertising person in a magazine. That would have been interesting. I think it would have been beneficial, actually.
Yeah.
Nobody ever suggested that. Just to make the magazines kind of its own in-page, on-page promotion of itself, which is a lot of what you do.
Yeah.
Selling subscriptions, next issue trails, talking about the promotion come and all that stuff. Whereas then you'd come to an advert and you'd always feel that suddenly the tone of voice had changed. It was no longer the magazine speaking to you. It was somebody from advertising land.
Some young creative who's trying to make a name for himself.
Yeah, a little bit over sophisticated.
Yeah.
A little bit too cool for school,
Were you aware of any advertising actually helping you, either in trade or national? That's Just 17 had a lot of TV ads, I remember.
It did, and he must have done. Help? Well, it would, because it was your way of telling people about big promotions, basically. You know, if he had a gizmo on the cover or something. It must have. Worked as part of a big marketing campaign. You would put a thing item on the cover, and it would be, and you'd have to get the timing right. The thing I do remember, being really outraged by the fact that you could be, in the old days of ITV, you could be preempted by the fact that, if, I don't know, Persil decided they wanted the first break on Coronation Street, they got it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's just bloody outrageous, but that's that world, we used to worry a lot about that kind of thing. But do I think any of the magazines could have made it without advertising? Yes, I think they probably could, actually.
What with The Economist, which is probably the most successful publication campaign in my time in advertising, I used to work on that. Essentially, they're all brand ads. They're all saying, this is kind of what The Economist stands for. All those red posters, you think.
Yeah.
Or every other thing I worked on was pushing a particular tactical thing. You know, we've got a Brando serialization, we've got a free gift, we've got this thing. And in a way, in retrospect, they all kind of blend in. Because whereas The Economist said, this is who we are, this is what we join our gang, we're the clever, smart, funny
people. Yeah. Yeah,
and all the others were saying, this is our latest thing, this is our latest thing.
No, that's very, it's a very good point. And, you know, is the I'm trying to remember Economist ads. I know they got mixed up maybe with FT ads. But I always used to feel that there was a kind of sell that you could make to ambitious people in companies. You said, your reading this is a sign of earnestness, is a sign of your seriousness, you know. And therefore your boss will notice it.
Yeah.
And it'll probably have a benefit for your career. I always thought that was a really powerful point.
That's exactly what the brief was on The Economist.
Yeah,
they would say things like, would you like to sit next to you at dinner? The edge of a conversation. The loneliest place on earth. So it's like saying, come on,
yeah,
you know, learn more, get part of the program. You know, yeah. It's like inviting you to.
It's about it's taking you in your work capacity and saying, okay, are you the kind of person who's going to get on? Do you want to get
on? Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's a quite simple proposition to put to people.
Yeah.
And some people will respond favorably to it and some people just go over their head. There's nothing in the world of you couldn't do that in the world of Mojo. You couldn't say
there isn't an equivalent in Mojo.
You couldn't say, although interestingly, the implicit sell of Mojo is you are that kind of person who knows a lot, but you can't say it. You really can't say it. You know, I post a lot of stuff on Instagram, just, you know, about old records or whatever. And I saw one yesterday I posted something and somebody in response, I never respond to the responses, can't get involved in it. But it says, somebody is talking about, yeah, we liked that record because the normies didn't get it. The normies. And I thought, that's the thing about music, is that if you make overt all the things that are just implicit, you make yourself look like a complete dick straight away. Are you the kind of person who wants to know more about Neil Young than anybody else? Well, clearly they are, but they don't want. You couldn't say that to people. You couldn't say that to people because you just make them look like a dick. You know.
It did make me wonder how much of a magazine, these magazines that you're building up and launching, how much of that is their vibe and how much is the pure content?
Oh, the vibe's hugely important. Hugely.
Empire is saying you're a bit of a film buff.
Well, yeah. It's Empire's got an interesting journey, actually. You know, the Empire was launched as a kind of, as a cue for, you know, movies people. Yeah. And you know, as far as I know, I don't know a lot about it, but I think Empire still does really well, actually. Yeah. But it does really well with that kind of theme of kind of, you know, superhero films and, you know, the kind of people who have to go and see everything on the day it opens.
Yeah.
And they have to go and see it twice or whatever. Yeah, and they're really nerdy. And they go and see everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You couldn't say that to them, but they're the kind of people that Empire will occasionally do, you know, where there's a new Star Wars film or whatever it is, they'll do five different covers and people will buy all five.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of victims. They're quite happy being victims.
Yeah.
But you couldn't openly say that. But I mean, how much was the vibe really important? Really important. And so if you go back to the choice of covers, and the reason you end up with this quite narrow range, now you ended up with a narrow range over a long, long period of time, was that if, you know, not everybody likes Bruce Springsteen, for instance.
Yeah.
But everybody, whether they like him or not, they recognize his right to be there.
Yeah.
He brings with him lots of, you know, vibrations.
Yeah, yeah.
History, charisma, America, all those things, which people warm to massively. And, you know, it's the reason why you could always put Neil Young on the cover of a magazine, but you could never put David Crosby on the cover of a magazine. Because everybody looks at Neil Young and goes, Neil Young?
Yeah.
It's just Neil Young. Everybody has permission to like Neil Young. David Crosby, not so much. Stephen Stills, definitely not at all. Graham Nash, forget it. Neil Young, you know, it's like not everybody likes Oasis, but everybody recognizes Oasis, yeah, right to be there. And do they think that Oasis represents that world? Yes, they do. You know, and the same thing doesn't apply to. Same thing doesn't apply to the Arctic Monkeys, oddly enough. You know, it's just, you know, some people, and I suppose this is where you run into the inevitable awful word iconic. That's what it means, you know. And so it was always REM, the Beatles, you know, Oasis, Nirvana, you know. And then Madonna, and, but you couldn't go, you couldn't do Dido because Dido just doesn't carry anything with her at all, you know. And so it's quite a narrow cast of stars. And then the biggest change during the time I was involved with music magazines was it used to be, if you take the late '70s, early '80s. The best thing you could put on the cover of a music magazine was the hot new thing. It always was. It, you know, whether it was the Sex Pistols or Seek Seek Sputnik or Television or God knows what. And then it stopped being the best thing. Nobody wants the hot new thing. They want the
There was a period when you don't want Lou Rondo a la Turk or something on the cover. You want someone who's proven their worth over a number of years.
Reassurance is what people look to covers for. You know, am I buying the right thing? I'm sure the same thing applies with football magazines and car magazines. You probably never go wrong with an old picture of a Jag on a car magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
You never go wrong with a picture of Liverpool on a football magazine. It's reassurance.
Yeah.
You know, because football is quite a good analogy because, you know, not everybody likes Liverpool, but everybody recognises Liverpool's right to be there.
So did you have relationships with ad agencies, of media agencies? Because obviously they're, you know, it's a symbiotic thing where it's only now that you realise both advertising, certainly print advertising and magazines are sort of dying. And was there much of a relationship? Did you try and court certain advertisers? Not just because of their money, but because of what they said about the readership?
Well, it wouldn't have been anything I was particularly involved in. But, you know, that was the big change, you know, that if you'd looked at the early issues of Q, it would have been mainly music magazines, advertisers. And then if you look, you know, 10 years later, whatever, it's in the kind of high noon of glossy magazines in the 90s, and you've got FHM and, you know, and all these things selling unprecedented numbers of copies to men, you've then got everything. You've got cars, you've got beer, you've got credit cards, you've got holidays, you've got, because absolutely everybody wants to be in there, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, we would have relationships with them. I wouldn't say it was a great meeting of minds or anything like that, you know. They were always... I always got the feeling that you go for these meetings. And they always wanted to be friends, and we always wanted to be friends. And we always went away afterwards thinking, wankers. They probably thought the same thing about us. You know, I'm sure. You know, but that's just how it's going to be. Because, you know, there's a part of people on successful magazines, they always really think they could do the ad better themselves. And there's always the guys in the advertisers, the agencies probably think they could edit the magazine better than you could. Just inevitable, you know.
Well, at least in 2000, you were on the campaign press awards jury.
Oh, was I?
I can't remember. With all those advertising wankers judging what was the best out of the year.
I honestly can't remember. And I'm sure they made sure that my contribution was overwhelmed by people who knew what they were doing, knew what they were talking about, I'm sure. But it's very funny. I'll tell you what. I don't know exactly when it was, but they used to campaign. I think was it campaign. They used to do a thing called, was it Media Mind or something? I don't know.
They used to have a media section. Yeah.
They used to have a thing. Well, once a year, they used to have at a conference. They used to have competing presentations by people on behalf of telly, outdoor press, whatever.
Which was the best.
And I remember, and this was not long after Word launched, I was somehow going to do this. And it was a hotel in Scotland, I remember. It was a residential thing. And it was a knockout. You know, you started with everybody. You started with somebody from Mirror Group. You started with somebody from ITV. I don't know. Stevie Spring was from Clear Channel at the time. Outdoor, I can't remember absolutely everybody. Some was radio, whatever. And there was a knockout. And, it started out with eight, and then you got down to four. And then it was knockout. And I won.
Oh, really?
I won because I could talk better than the rest of them. It didn't mean anything at all, you know. But you'd... it's all those years of kind of fighting your corner, I suppose. I did quite a lot of that because magazines were growing and EMAP was growing and it was a public company. Therefore, what the stock exchange thought was quite important. And so Sir Frank Rogers, who was the chairman, used to occasionally get me in to talk to a bunch of bankers or something like that. You know, I did a bit of that.
But also, you probably felt very confident at the time because the company was doing so well. So
that absolutely
probably radiates that you're slightly arrogant during making your case. Because it's such a weird thing to argue, is TV better than print? And it's like, are apples better than oranges?
But I had some good lines. And this is an example of a good line that I had, which no longer holds true.
Right.
Which is, I stood up and said, it is impossible to be really interested in the subject without reading a magazine about it.
Okay.
And the room full of people went, yep.
That would have been true.
It would have been true. Not true anymore. Hadn't been true for years.
So it sounds like you did your homework before. You prepared properly.
Oh, God, yeah. Not kidding. Probably more than they did.
That's what I'm saying,
That's years of doing whistle test and everything. I over prepare for everything. I do when I do anything nowadays, anything. If people ever say to me afterwards, "That was good," I always think the same thing is, you have no idea how much preparation I've put in. You would simply not believe, because that's never got less over the years, you know.
That's what they say about Martin Short as the best guest on any chat show. And they say it's because he prepares.
I'm sure he does.
You know, he does it, and nobody has that same level of preparation as Martin.
I'm sure. No, I actually read, I think I read Tina Fey. I watched her doing a little thing talking about doing chat shows. And she said, Martin Short told me this, or Steve Martin told me, or whatever. Same thing, Steve Martin, Martin Short. Which when a comedian goes on a chat show, they have worked out the material. Well, you've got to do that. But then again, a chat show, they haven't got to do it for very long.
No. 10-minute segment.
Yeah.
So do you remember a point when digital turned up and you thought this could be a problem?
well, yes. But I don't remember anybody thinking it would have the effect that it did. You know, it was a yeah. classic case of that. Did they say overestimated in the short term, underestimated in the long term?
Yeah. Yeah.
That we're all doing lots of things to do digital versions of the products and so forth, trying to do probably overcomplicated things where we thought, you know, this is how it would fit alongside a magazine, not really contemplating the fact that a load of people would just wake up one day in the 21st century and find that they no longer felt the need to buy a magazine. You know, it just gone. You know, that habit, which used to be such an enormous part of so many people's lives, has gone. But it's still, you know, it hangs on in, you know, like the political weeklies, the New Yorkers, the Spectators, the, you know, the Private Eyes, and then oddly enough, in the world of TV listings, things like Radio Times, you know. So it's pockets of odd habits that hang on. But the basic habit of a 25-year-old person of thinking, I've got to go into I've got to buy a newspaper. Oh, and look, they've got the new copy of, you know, GQ or whatever there. It's gone.
I've got into a couple of books on Condé Nast, Graydon Carter, a lot of them related to the magazine industry. And there doesn't seem to be a point when they go, hang on, this is just like a slow erosion. And looking at the immense money and scale of Condé Nast and how they treated people is just unbelievable now.
The great mystery to me, Condé Nast, you know, the home of smoke and mirrors. And, you know, they were bloody good at what they did, you know, bloody good at it. But the thing that amazed me is that they woke up one morning and decided that Glamour in the UK was no longer worth publishing. And I thought, well, hang on. The ABC of that was about 300,000, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or was it? Yeah. Because if it was 300,000, there's no way they'd stop. No way in the world they'd stop. You know, because it was that's a really profitable business. Well, clearly it wasn't.
Did you ever speak to them about getting a job there? Or
I would never. I like Nick Coleridge and, you know, and Dylan Jones and, you know, people like mates who worked at Condé Nast. I never in a million years would they have, you know, I'm just not really? The guy. Oh, God, never in a million years. I'm not their kind of person, you know, they were all about selling to the ABC ones, you know.
Well, they took on James Brown, I would imagine he's
that's true. Their sort of person. That's true. But they got rid. they did get rid. And probably James is more my side of the of the argument than Condé Nast. And interestingly enough, I think I'm right in saying what made them get rid was that he let daylight in on magic, didn't he? Which is he said Hugo Boss got started doing. Uniforms for the Nazis, which of course is true.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you can't say that with the advertiser in the room. You know, you go back to the thing with email. Thing with Condé Nast is an advertising, and this is certainly back in the past. It probably still is now. It's an advertiser-focused business.
Yeah,
EMAP was a reader-focused business.
Right.
Please the readers and the advertisers will come along. If you build it, they will come. Condé Nast, other way around.
The other way around.
Entirely. You know, we'll please the advertisers now. How few people do we have to get to buy this to continue pleasing the advertisers? That's fine.
Yeah.
Totally different business.
So the last thing I wanted to cover is just your books, really, because the style of them has become the generic.
Yeah, I did that.
The generic music book style. So it makes me laugh. So there, I don't know how planned out that was, but the black and white, orange type, orange graphics that's been consistent throughout is a brilliant brand campaign.
I'll tell you that. I'll tell you the story of this. I'll tell you the story of this. First book, 1971. I talked to Bill Scott Kerr is the publisher, and Richard Shaler is the art guy, and one of the things when I got a book deal, sorry, I'm going to have to go slight tangent. Go on, sir. Because, you know, I got agent and we punted the idea around and nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted it. And apart from Transworld, Bill Scott Kerr. And I went in for a meeting with Bill Scott Kerr afterwards. And I said to Charlie, my agent, afterwards, I said, do they like the book or do they like me? He said, I think they like you. I said, oh, fine, okay. And the reason they like me is that because of my magazine background, I talk like somebody wanted to sell something.
Yeah.
Which most writers don't do at all. Yeah. And therefore I had views. I had real views on what was going to be on the cover. Now you would not believe how few views most writers have on these things. I have massive views on these things. Yeah. And so Bill said, oh, find some pictures, you know. And so I sorted out a bunch of pictures on the agency, sent him links. And then we looked at this Keith Richard Graham Parsons on the sofa. Can we get this? Yeah, we'll try and get this. And then Richard designed it, pretty much designed it. Yeah, I think he did it on his own, you know, the orange and the white and all that. And great, Richard. I thought he did a fantastic job. And then when it came time for the second book, which was Uncommon People, similar old picture, old black and white picture of David Bowie coming out the back of a limousine at Hammersmith. Yeah. And then the first, and I've probably got it here, the first pass Richard did at it, it was no longer orange, it was red, or it was blue. I can't remember what. And I looked at it and I said to Bill and Richard, I said, based on my experience of Q, if you look at Q, the early covers, red, and then we tried blue, we tried green, yellow. We tried yellow, and then we went back to red. Because red and black, and there was Andy Cowles, who was the art director, said, it's the sun, it's the Daily Mirror, it's black and white, it's urgent, it's newsy, it's a bit male. And I said to Bill and Richard, I think it's better to be recognized as effectively the same thing and risk the fact that people think it's not new than to do something not as powerful, but it's different. Yeah. You're better off being powerful and risk being the same. And I think there's loads of examples of that. In the marketing of loads of things, you know, and loads of books, and you know, which have been done in the same way. And so ever since then, it's been, you know, that's the way it works. And of course, nowadays, there's loads of orange, and you know, people send me things all the time. Another orange color.
You know. Well, the weird thing is, I mean, you interview people about their book, which is ripped off your graphic. So the other week, someone who I used to play football with, Dominic Mohan, was on.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked at his book, and you think, wouldn't you be slightly uncomfortable that you've essentially said, could we make it look like David's?
Well, he won't have said that. Publisher will have said that.
No, I guess so. But and then it's funny, when I was sort of trying to find book covers and things, you can find your books in different graphics for different, and they look weird.
Oh, listen, American publishers.
American, they've spoofed, I think one of them spoofed the Rolling Stone. And you think that's a sort of...
What's his name? Who does the rest of his entertainment? Richard, what's his name? Somebody asked him, what have been the worst, the biggest waste of time conversations you've ever had in your career? And he thought about it. He said, anything involving an American television company.
Oh, really?
And I thought, yeah. you talk to American publishers till you're blue in the mouth. You're wasting your time. They're not listening.
They know.
And because you go and you got the experience. Here are, now everybody in British publishing would agree on one thing, whether they think I'm useless or not. They would all agree, if you asked everybody in the Grosvenor House to put their hands up and say, is the branding of David Hepworth's books a good thing or a bad thing? They would all say, yes, it's a good thing. And yet every time an American publisher gets it, they're like, no, not over here, matey.
Not orange in this country. Doesn't work.
Doesn't work. And, the things I've had with publishers overseas, I had a thing with an Italian publisher not long ago, because, they sell the rights, and they say, well, you've got to okay it. I say, okay. They send it to me, and I go, I don't like that. And they go, well, I can't do anything about it.
Yeah, you just okay it.
Honestly, the number of times I've said, over my dead body, that is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. Because I always pull out the same line, which is, thanks to my experience in magazines, I am the world's greatest expert in the stupid things that designers do in the hope of impressing their mates. I know. I've seen it all a million bloody times. So don't come it with me. Yeah. I had these arguments with far better designers than you, mate, years ago. Don't tell me that one again, and I still don't get my way. But I do with the English ones, so that's fine.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, that's why you should have done your own ads as well. I'm sure you could have done those.
Well, I don't know.
I don't think the ad agencies helped you much.
Well,
that's amazing, though. I really appreciate your time.
That's all right. Pleasure. Brilliant.